Beginning in the early 1960s, DC Comics had an on-again, off-again feature called Strange Sports Stories, which, as the title suggests, featured sports stories, be they baseball, football, even bowling, that had a science fiction or horror slant on them. There's one such story in the August-September 1963 issue of The Brave and the Bold, number 49. The cover features what at first glance appears to be a gorilla sliding ahead of the throw into third base just beneath an astonished third baseman. Looking at it now, what strikes me is just how wrong it is, and I'm not just talking about the fact that the gorilla resembles no primate ever seen on Earth, and we only know it's a gorilla exactly because there's a caption on the bottom of the cover identifying the title of the story as Gorilla Wonders of the Diamond, which sounds all kinds of thrilling, except that the field is laid out wrong. Fair territory and the base path is to the third baseman's left, which means that maybe we're not looking at a third baseman, but we're looking at a first baseman, in which case the gorilla is sliding into first base from foul territory and the first baseman is taking a pickoff throw from the dugout? I don't know. I doubt very much that the publisher cared. DC had discovered that if they put a gorilla on the cover of a book, any book at that point in time, it sold better than any comic book that didn't have a gorilla on the cover. So who cares if the ball game is wrong or it's not quite a gorilla? I mean, maybe this is how gorillas play baseball. They slide into first base from foul territory. That seems like something a gorilla would do, doesn't it? Put that aside. What strikes me most when I look at this cover is I don't know whether I identify more with the third baseman playing his game, even though something surreal is happening and he doesn't quite understand what's going on, or the pseudo-gorilla who's playing his game, even though he doesn't understand the rules. He's got a big grin on his face, and even though he's probably not winning sliding into bases from foul territory, he's definitely having a good time. That's the nature of living in the infinite inning. I'm Stephen Goldman, and for the first time ever, this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. We hope will be an ongoing series of baseball podcasts here at FanRack, your upstart sports emporium, as we refer to ourselves around the water cooler. Actually, to be honest, I don't know what we refer to ourselves as around the water cooler, as the water cooler is located in Arizona, which is far, far away from where I'm sitting right now, and no doubt they're probably not too keen on sports emporium, as that sounds like something out of the 1890s. Everything's up to date at the Sports Emporium. Cigars on the left, buffalo carcasses on the right, and that's probably not a productive avenue to go down. It really does sound kind of ancient, kind of pre-war, by which I mean pre-First World War, if not pre-Civil War, if not pre-Hundred Years' War. Anyway, let me not beat this to death any further and tell you a little bit more about what we're doing here, about myself, and then we will be joined by the first of our regular co-hosts, Jesse Spector, more about whom in a moment. So what is this? Well, this is a baseball podcast, and the goal is to tell stories. And I know that that sounds very general, so let me see if I can narrow it down a little bit. First, the specifics. I will be here every week. I will be joined by a rotating series of co-hosts. Jesse Spector, who was with the Sporting News and now is at FanRag, my good friend Cliff Corcoran, late of SportsIllustrated.com and now of Sports on Earth and diverse other publications, and my once and current colleague David Roth, who is a columnist at Vice, and that's someplace that I show up when I'm not writing here at FanRag. And in the fourth week, I hope to be judged by a player... Judged? Ha ha! See, that's a Freudian slip, my friends. Hope to be joined by a player to be named later, somebody different each week where we can talk about different topics and getting about as far afield from baseball as you can without losing sight of baseball completely. And that may mean talking about baseball with non-baseball people who hopefully have ideas of interest, and talking about non-baseball subjects with baseball people who are hardly one-dimensional in their interests and their pursuits. The point, and this is what I mean about telling stories, is I'm an analytical guy. I'm not a rah-rah guy, as an editor at SB Nation said to me one time when their readers were disappointed in the way that I covered a particular baseball team, which was supposed to be about, you know, not homerism, I guess, but boosterism. Maybe that's the same thing. It's not something I'm real comfortable with. I would not be part of any organization that would have me as a member, and I'm do not like organizing publicity junkets. I would rather be honest and critical and forthright and not necessarily negative. But, you know, there are enough cheerleaders out there that why would you read somebody who only reinforced your point of view? Boy, that's the most naive thing that I'm going to say all day in this political era in which we are all sealed in our little epistemological bubbles. And yet, that's kind of the right way to look at it. I've written this before, but paraphrasing the great G.K. Chesterton, the multifarious British writer, saying my team right or wrong is like saying my mother drunk or sober. You don't have to love the team shortstop just because he's wearing the local laundry. If he's not good, if there's a better choice out there, if he's not playing well, it's not disloyal. It's not hypercritical to point out that he's not playing well. And that extends not just to the utility infielder who the team has stuck at that position this year, but to the stars on that team. And, you know, I came of age, and maybe this is a good time to talk about where I came from, but I first became noticed as a professional writer as someone who wrote about the Yankees on a site called the Pinstripe Bible for, I don't know, about 10 or so years. And at that time, this is going back to the mid to late 1990s now, that Derek Jeter was the big star in New York. And of course, the ongoing controversy was whether his defense was any good or not. The metrics said no, and the fans said yes. And they couldn't accept that he was a really, really good Hall of Fame level shortstop. He just wasn't perfect at everything. And if you watched it, you could see it. You could see he could go to his right really, really well. He could go back on pop-ups as well as anybody you ever saw. But if he ever went to his left, I mean, I don't know that he ever did. I mean, this is the problem. You could watch the other team come into Yankee Stadium, and you would watch their shortstop go behind second base to make a play, range to his left and cut off a ball up the middle. Derek Jeter just wasn't capable of that. Now, he did so many other things well that obviously the Yankees came out ahead on that transaction, and they won plenty of championships while he was there, and it shouldn't have been controversial at all. But to point out that the emperor was flawed was like saying that the emperor had no value at all, and of course that's not remotely the case. I feel like I might have gotten a little off the track here, but the point is, that's what made him so interesting. It wasn't just that he could play, but that he aroused these emotions in others, that he wasn't real capable of talking about it himself. And in the end, we're not really just talking about performance or wins and losses, all of which are pretty basic when you get down to it. But we're talking about a story, about feelings, about the emotions that are created by the situation. His, mine, yours. It's more than just wins and losses. And of course, there's interest in that. Breaking down those things is still a lot of fun for me. At the same time, I feel like that too has become kind of rote. And you see a lot of stories, sometimes at the better publications, that kind of say Mike Trout is a good player because he hits 300, and he hits 300 because he's a good player. And I wonder what we take away from that. Except perhaps that someone had a deadline to meet, and they decided to meet it by recapitulating the back of Trout's baseball card in a way that provided no insight whatsoever, and that further someone decided to publish that. But so many of the discussions we have been reduced to that level. And so this is what I want to do here. I want to have a good general interest baseball podcast that has numbers but doesn't get bogged down in the numbers, that loves prospects but doesn't spend so much time on the coming attractions that it misses the movie, that roots in a general sense for good baseball and makes an argument about good baseball and what makes a good team and a bad team, but isn't about homerism and panting after a particular club or a particular set of players, that's not afraid to be critical and isn't afraid to explore areas that go outside the lines, because you know what? I've been doing this for a long time, and baseball writers are some of the smartest people I know. Well, to be fair, they're also some of the only people I know. I don't get around as much as I used to. Still, I think you'll see that I'm right about that. As for me, the rest of my story is brief. In addition to doing the Pinstripe Bible, I wrote the biography of Casey Stengel, Forging Genius, and joined Baseball Prospectus, where I was a writer and a columnist and then a contributing editor. I edited 7 of the annuals, edited or co-edited, I should say, in fairness. Some other books like Mind Game about the Red Sox and Extra Innings, More Baseball Between the Numbers, and the Baseball Prospectus Pen and Race book. And I'm probably leaving out some stuff in there. I got to be editor-in-chief for a while, and then eventually I moved on to SB Nation. But I have to be honest with you that there was a time where, because of this divide that I've been talking about between stories and the way that baseball is talked about now, I didn't really feel like I belonged for a while. That's why this is the infinite inning, because the quest to find a place for oneself, especially when one feels that one no longer belongs, very often doesn't find its third out. It just goes on. And it seems to me that some of you may also know what that feels like, to be in a situation where you're unresolved, where something that you love, you don't love in quite the same way that you used to, and you're trying to find a new way to love it. Let me close with this, and then we'll get on to Jesse. And I promise these introductory segments won't be quite as long in the future. At least I hope not. There was a pitcher named Tiny Bonham, who I've been thinking about, who pitched mostly for the Yankees in the 1940s, for the Yankees and the Pirates. He was not Tiny. His real name was Ernie. Tiny was entirely sarcastic. This is a quote from the New York Times. According to the record books, Bonham packed 210 pounds on his 6'2" frame, but that was a very modest estimate of his poundage. If you look at pictures of him, he looked kind of square. He had a big lantern jaw. And although 6'2 and 200-something pounds doesn't sound a lot to us today, you have to remember that not everyone was 6'2 back then. Nutrition and exercise and so on wasn't what it is now. So if you say you look at the if you look at films of soldiers going off to the First World War, or the Second World War for that matter, they're kind of short a lot of the time. So a guy who is 6'2", 210, or over that, he was kind of big for that age. Now, the thing about Bonham was he didn't come up till 26 just because the Yankees were so packed and because he wasn't a stuff guy. He was a forkball guy. He's one of the few pitchers in history to have excelled throwing the forkball. And the neat thing about that, if you look at the back of his baseball card or his baseball reference card, whichever you have handy, whether you're in analog or digital kind of mood, is he never walked anybody. And if you've seen pitchers throw the split-finger fastball, whether you're old enough to have seen Mike Scott and the guys who came after him emulating him, when hitters knew to lay off of it, it was inevitably a ball because it heads for the middle of the strike zone and then it dives. It looks like just your run-of-the-mill fastball before it just quits altogether and disappears. When hitters can lay off of it, or if the pitcher has trouble locating it, they walk a lot of guys. But Bonham never walked anyone. He just walked 1.7 per nine innings for his career, and he had a couple of seasons where he was closer to one. In his best year, which was 1942, and don't discount that year entirely, because you know not all of the American ballplayers had gone off into the war effort yet. He went 21-5. He had a 2.27 ERA, and he walked 24 batters in 226 innings. he got to keep pitching through the war because he was 4F. He had bad back problems, and those back problems wore him down as he got into his 30s. And in 1946, the Yankees traded him to the Pirates for a journeyman they never used named Cookie Cucurullo. And you know you've fallen far in the world when you've basically been, you know, kind of a Cy Young level guy, and now you're being traded for Cookie Cucurullo. So he goes to the Pirates, and he doesn't really have a lot left. He works as a swing man. The Pirates are pretty mediocre. They had Ralph Kiner and not a bunch else, although they did have this sort of surprising 1948 season under a manager named Billy Meyer, who had been Tiny Bonham's manager going way back into the minor leagues, like starting 10 years before in 1938, because he was in the Yankee system. They both were. And the Pirates in 48, they went 83-71. And that was such a shocking thing for the Pirates to do at that time, and possibly maybe shocking on occasion for the Pirates now still. Meyer got the Manager of the Year award from the Sporting News. Bonham was really happy about that. In general, it's a good time, but, you know, he's 36. It's 1949. He's talking about retiring, going home to California. And that September, he has abdominal pain. And the doctors, they take a look at him, and they I don't know how they determined these things back then, maybe with x-rays, maybe just by feeling around, but they say, Tiny, your appendix has gone back on you. We got to take it out. So he goes into the hospital, and they cut him open, and I don't know what happened to the appendix exactly, what the real state of it was, but what they found was, in fact, intestinal cancer. And so they keep him there. And during this period that he is supposedly recuperating, his manager, Billy Meyer, again, his friend going back over 10 years through this professional association, visits him. And I don't know if these were exactly Tiny Bonham's last words or what his state of mind was, if he was in his right mind, if he was delirious, if he was on painkillers. I assume that some of that is probably true. But he looked at his manager and his old friend, and he said, Bill, they're hitting me all over the field, and I can't get anybody out. Tiny never went home. He lingered in the hospital for about a week. Somewhere in there, he said those words, and he passed away. It's not my intention to compare what happened to him directly to some of the things that I've been talking about here in this initial introduction, except that I do think what he described is, in its own way, the definition of the infinite inning. We, in fact, would, I hope, honor him by expanding what he's talking about to encompass not just the mortal situation he was in. And I've had cancer twice, so I kind of have some idea of what he's talking about, although I've been fortunate enough, obviously, since I'm talking to you, to still be here, but to expand the definition of what he's saying to encompass those situations in life where they are hitting you all over the field and you don't know how to approach it. You don't know what the solution is to this new set of variables where the pitches that you've been throwing, which were once effective, which were once joyful to you, don't work in the same way that they used to for reasons that aren't quite clear to you. And I hope that's something that, as we talk about the current game, as we talk about the situation in baseball, whether that's how the Cubs are doing, how the Yankees are doing, how the Brewers are doing, whoever, or specific players, or Hall of Fame cases, or prospects, or baseball films, or how we split our attention between the game and the rest of the world, which is an ever more urgent question as the real world is getting real and knocks on our door and gets in the way of the things we want to do and would enjoy doing. I hope that as we explore those topics, we also explore the solution to the infinite inning, and that we can make the infinite inning not a test or an ordeal, but a thing of joy, because what would be so bad, even if they are hitting you all over the field, about getting to play forever? We'll be back, I'll be back, with Jesse Spector in just a moment.
Jesse, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I wanted to tell people about how we met because I think it gets at something interesting in terms of kind of the sports writing business and where we've both gone from there. And stop me if this is too personal, but you and I never really got a chance to discuss this once it happened. This goes back a few years, and I was a managing editor for baseball at a publication, and you were at a different publication and possibly looking to move on. So we got lunch, and I don't think you knew, I'm telling you for the first time, that turned out to be one of many crisis points or inflection points or really difficult days in my career. Meeting you, and I don't want you to take this personally, was kind of like doing the ice bucket challenge.
In what way?
Well, you're a good writer. You're a respected writer. So I was excited to meet with you and possibly recruit you. That was my goal, to have a staff of good writers and really professional writers and kind of put together the super friends of baseball commentary, or the Justice League of baseball commentary, whatever version you want.
Yeah.
The people that I worked for were very reluctant to expend money for content. And I needed to persuade them of that using all of the Jedi mind tricks at my disposal, which were few, as it turned out. And then I met you, and you gave me a quote that was many decimal places and commas and figures larger than anything conceivable in their wildest imaginations. In fact, was larger than what I was making at that time to sit there with you. I'm not a jealous guy. You understand. And,
yes.
And I think that one of the things that's really dangerous to do in your life is to sit there and say, why does the good thing that happened for that other guy not happen for me if I'm in my own way as skilled, or if I'm, I'm not comparing myself to you as a writer. I don't know that I should compare myself to anybody as a writer, but just, you've been at it a certain amount of time. You have a certain amount of reputation, and you say that should happen for me. And in fact, I was very tempted, and I don't know how you would have handled this if I had done this, to just reverse the terms of the meeting at that point and say, actually, maybe you could hire me. And I don't know what would have happened then, but I realized not only was I not going to get the Justice League, but that I had gone very, very wrong somewhere.
Yeah, you could have dropped that on me before we came on the air. I had no idea that was the case. And I think that part of the reason that I don't have a full-time job now is probably the dollar figure that was associated with my name there. I don't know. I don't know. They never gave me a satisfactory explanation of why I was being let go from, from where I was. I don't think it's a secret that I was at Sporting News and they let me go. Very quick Google would, find that. I never really understood it. Maybe it was what I was making, but I was hired in 2012 there, so it's not like the industry was doing great at that point. I had gotten a raise when I got there from what I was making in my previous job, but I'm well aware at this point with eyes wide open that if I'm going back to something full-time at any point, it's probably going to be for a lot less than I was making before. And I think that when we met, those years ago, I was pretty honest in the belief that, if I was going to be going somewhere else, it would probably be for less money. I was just kind of looking for a bit of a different challenge. And I think that that's something that since I've been freelancing since November, And by the way, that was a great week. You know, you have the election, and then 2 days later, lose your job. That was awesome. Really endorse that and want to go through that ever again. You don't go into this business for money, I don't think. And now I will make less of it than I ever have before, and that's fine.
The reason that I bring it up is not to make either of us feel bad over money, because I think that's an arc for a lot of writers of a certain age, that their career trajectory goes that way, that you come in and you work for very little, or in many cases work for some cases for free or very little, and then you attain kind of a certain height, and then a very small percentage of people gets to stay at that height or go on from that height, even if they're as talented as you are. So I don't want to make that a personal thing, because I don't think it's a personal thing. I think sometimes bad things happen to good people or talented people. I just wonder if you think that's the, as I said, the overall trend in sports writing, especially those of us that are centered online, although I don't know if that distinction is even worth making at this point.
I don't think it is. I think if you're writing right now, there's, you know what, there is one place that it's, that there is a distinction, and it's a place, an environment that I'm happy to work in and actually have very much enjoyed as part of freelancing. I'm writing for Rockies magazine now, you know, their stadium program, and that's an awesome thing, because for me, like, I still have, you know, some of my Yankees magazines and Mets magazines from when I was a kid, and like reading those made me get into baseball as even more than I already was, and get into reading and all that. So to be able to write for a stadium magazine these days is cool, and the fact that it's, for one thing, my name hasn't been in print outside of once a year. You know, in the Sporting News baseball preview magazine, they would print stuff that I did. But aside from that, it's been like 4 years since I was in print regularly. And to see my name and over, you know, the magazine comes in the mail, the Rockies send it to me, and I open it up, and there's my thing. That's still a really cool feeling. So there is that distinction there, but in general, no, there's no distinction, and really, you're primarily writing for online, even if you're writing for a newspaper, because your newspaper might have a circulation of 200,000. There's no 200,000 people that are reading every single story in the newspaper, let alone, you know, unless you're, I'm trying to pull a name right now, and I'm going because of Costanza right to Mike Lupica, but he's not, is he at the Daily News anymore? Is he just Sports on Earth now, or? How does that even?
Yeah, I haven't actually physically touched a Daily News in a long, long time, so I don't.
Yeah,
know.
I worked there for 8 years, and I have not bought the newspaper, honestly. And it's ridiculous to say this because I've worked in this industry, and you know, it was my livelihood for, you know, so many years. Why would you buy the print newspaper unless, like, to do the crossword?
I kind of do. I get the Times every day. I think more out of habit than anything else, but I end up reading a chunk of it online anyway. And there are probably days that it goes straight to recycling, but there's something about holding that broadsheet, which isn't as wide as it used to be.
Sure.
It's a nostalgic habit, and it's probably one that eventually I'll lose, or they'll tell me I have to lose it.
Yeah. And like, if they start, if all the newspapers in America got together and said, okay, we're all putting up a paywall. This is, you know, I don't know how they make it work eventually. They either have to, or, you know, we'll go in the direction. I don't know. I don't have the answer. Way smarter people than me have tried to come up with the answer. I don't have it. I don't know. But yeah, like I can't remember the last time that I bought a physical newspaper. As much as, yeah, like, I've gotten, you know, been to a hotel and they, you know, put USA Today on your doorstep, and yeah, it is cool to hold it, and, you know, occasionally I'll have, you know, the Times at the library or whatever, and yeah, it's something, but it's just, I'm gonna spend $1.50 for this now, or whatever. I don't even know what it costs now, you know, for the physical paper. So it's way, like, even if you're on a site like, you know, the Times or the Washington Post, it's way cheaper to buy the access digitally, and you get more. So if you have that ability, I don't know why you wouldn't. And you know.
But that brings up I hadn't really intended to go here, but that brings up a question, which is you're endorsing sort of the consumer side of that. Now, from the other side, you're a content creator. You want to get paid.
Yeah, please pay me.
And if the paper's making less revenue, or the magazine, or the website, obviously that devolves on us eventually. This is not just confronting sports writers, but all journalists, right? That how do you make an adult wage in that environment?
I don't know. I wish I did know. I don't. And I don't know where it's all going. I feel like there's always going to be an audience for content. It's just a matter of, is the pay going to be there to support quality content? And I don't know. I don't know that, you know, what I've done necessarily even counts as that. And, you know, and I know that the stuff that, it's funny, like the stuff that clicks traffic wise. And I used to hate getting the traffic reports on stuff, 'cause it would just confirm all of your darkest suspicions about, you know, who's reading what. At least, like, when you're at a newspaper and, like, you write stories, you don't know how many people are reading. You know that not everybody who gets the paper is reading everything that you do, but, you know, they've bought the paper and everything that comes with it. When you're online, you can track, you know, exactly what pages are getting visited and for how long and how much time people are spending, you know, and how much they're coming back, if they're new visitors, if they're repeat visitors, and all that. And it's just, it, like I said, it confirms all of your worst suspicions that the basest stuff that you do is the stuff that, or just like the takiest stuff. Like, you know, it was always, anytime you wrote about the DH rule, it was going to get a million clicks. Anytime you wrote about Pete Rose, it was going to get a million clicks. Anytime you know, wrote about Curt Schilling opening his mouth and... You know, thank goodness I don't, like, that to me is one of the most wonderful things about freelancing as opposed to being full-time at a place, is that I do not have to give a rat's patoot about Curt Schilling opening his mouth or clicking on Twitter or doing anything. And it is so wonderfully freeing that is everybody else's business but mine now. I don't care, and that guy can go away forever.
And I think there's a certain relaxation too in when you're not on sort of the daily churn of having to provide content every day, and you can pick and choose your spots. You know what? If there's a no hitter today, you don't have to necessarily have a take on it, because I mean, if you've written one no hitter story, you've kind of written them all. If there's another PED story or Hall of Fame debate or one of those things that gets kind of tired after you've done it a million times, you can just sit this one out. And yeah, I mean, you know, you only get paid when you work, but there are so many other topics that you can pick that might be more satisfying to work on than something that you've been through a million times.
You know, honestly, that was the existential crisis that I had last year at the end of the World Series. I found myself, after Game 7, just walking around downtown Cleveland in, you know, essentially the middle of the night, thinking, how in the world am I ever going to cover another baseball game after that? After that game and after that series, what else could I possibly hope for that's going to top that? I've never seen a no-hitter or a perfect game or somebody hit for the cycle in person, but do I really feel like I have the need to write a story about having been at one? Not really. I'd like to see it in person, but I can go to games. What am I going to see? That, you know, the Cubs in Cleveland and the series that they played in Cleveland being up 3-1, and especially because, at least personally, I had written the column before Game 5 saying, all right, here's how Terry Francona needs to do it. He needs to let Trevor Bauer go once through the order, and that's it. Get him out of there. Don't let him go through the order a second time. You have Danny Salazar. You have all of these guys in the bullpen. You have a day off following. Get Bauer through. Don't let him face the meat of that order a second time around. Then he does. That's how they lose the game. They lose Game 6, and then Game 7 happens the way that it does. So I felt kind of cool about having, you know, said how Cleveland could win the series, only to see them go the opposite way when it looked like they could have made it work the way that I said, and then, you know, lose the series the way that they did. And Game 7 just being an all-timer of a game, plus the rain delay. amazing. Like, how would you top any of that? And, you know, here I am 6 months later back covering baseball for somebody else, a few somebody else's, right. But it's, it was a tough thing to digest. And yeah, it's all cyclical and you're trying to find new ways to say new things and it's not always there. And that's part of what I'm actually, another thing that I'm enjoying about freelancing is that I'm writing for different people who have different audiences, who have different things that they want me to write, and it's making me do different things. Like, I have, you know, editors at FanRag who, you know, want certain things, and editors at other places who want other things, and will have suggestions of, like, well, maybe you could do this, and it's like, oh, that's something that I haven't really, you know, worked that way before, but yeah, let's go in that direction and see where things go. So it's kind of freshened things up for me a little bit, you know, not to talk too much about my own experience, and I don't really remember where we were going with this, so let's move on to something else, because I'm not that comfortable talking about myself.
I'll tell you one thing, which is, I mean, I had sort of the same feeling after the end of the World Series, and I wasn't covering it in person, but just even watching it at a distance, I had the thought that, okay, well, we don't really need to do this anymore. I wasn't talking about writers then, even as a fan, like, okay, this was the apotheosis of the game. The Cubs 100-year-plus quest to win a World Series is over. It was done in this epic World Series with all these changes and of lead and a come from behind victory. It was almost as if this was the end of baseball, as people talked about when the Cold War ended, the end of history. Okay, we're done now. And that analogy is a good one to use, because that didn't turn out to be true. And I realized that I had the same thought before, and I forget, I know you're younger than I am, because I feel like everybody sort of in our end of the business is younger than I am, but I had the same feeling in 1998 when I was writing professionally, and we had, and forget everything that came after, because I couldn't know about the PED stuff and the Mitchell report and everything that would cast a negative light on what had happened that year after the fact.
Yeah.
But we had, you know, the Yankees win 110 or 112 games, whatever they won. And whether you're a Yankees fan or not, just in terms of raw numbers.
It was 114.
114, right. So they're up there with the 54 Indians and, yeah, and teams like that. And whether you're a Yankees fan or not, this is one of the most perfect teams of all time. Obviously, maybe it being an expansion year distorted that. You had the home run record with the great chase by McGuire and Sosa. Everybody feels great about that. And I must not have been the only person that felt that way, because I think even you just mentioned Mike Lupica. He came out with a book called The Perfect Summer. Yeah. So I thought, okay, we're done. Like, we don't have to do this anymore. Like, the story of baseball has kind of been told. It took a few years, but I think that story resets, or we find a new storyline or a new cause to embrace. And then it turns out that there's another climax coming.
Yeah, there's always something. And that's kind of the beauty of the sport, isn't it? There's always something. Like, we have, and this is such a weird thing, as good as Mike Trout is, I'm confident that I'm going to see baseball players in my lifetime who are better than Mike Trout if I live long enough. Yeah, he's a generational talent, sure. One of the best that there's ever been. He's going to be in the Hall of Fame. He's, you know, he's in the Hall of Fame, like, at 25. You know, that's crazy, but, like, if he was run over by a bus tomorrow, I think they'd make an exception and put him in, you know, because he hasn't played the service time years. But he'd, you know, run over by a bus, fine, he's in. I still think I'm going to see somebody better. The Cubs and the way that they did it and the way that postseason unfolded, I don't know how that gets matched, man. I just don't. And is Cleveland going to win someday? Probably. Washington going to win someday? Probably. Seattle, like, the Mariners are going to get a World Series at some point. Maybe, probably.
Not this year.
You don't know. Maybe it will be this year. I don't know. The Cubs thing was special because, like, it was so entrenched in everything. And to go outside of baseball, like, you know, I spent all of 2015 harping on, you know, the Northside Church of McFly because of Back to the Future 2 and the Cubs winning the World Series and that. Like, I have a t-shirt that says Cubs 2015 World Series Champions in the Back to the Future font. And, like, I didn't get that custom made. That was something that was available online. I was like, I gotta have that. I love that movie and it's awesome. The Cubs thing, I think, is on a different level than that. But, yeah, there's always something else ahead. And I think that we're already kind of into that of, like, yeah, baseball's happening again this year. There's new players. There's new stories to watch. Bartolo Colon is in Atlanta now. And, you know, still on pace to break Barry Bonds' record sometime in the year 15,000, I think it was. something like that. So, it's all good that we get to continue to do this and that wasn't actually the end of baseball and the end of history, as it were, but...
I got to stop you right there, actually, because this is really bothering me. I have a major problem with that movie. That movie really... Back to the Future picture really, really bothers me. And I here are my bona fides. I saw the original in the theater. I was 14 years old or something like that. Love the original. Still holds up for me. I've seen it a million times since then. Probably know it by heart. I mean, I do. I have a couple of issues with it. Maybe I was a very woke 14-year-old, but I mean, as much as the Chuck Berry joke or the Marvin Berry joke in the original is funny, the white appropriation there bugs me just a little bit. And I think it bugged me then. I won't say for sure, but I was always really into rock and roll history. So there's that. But here's the thing. In the second one, everything, and I haven't seen it for a long time because it made me this mad. Everything that Marty does is based on everyone around him saying, you know, you have that problem with rage control, Marty. You're so impulsive when you get angry, Marty. And that is not reference, is not a character trait anywhere in the first picture. It is purely retrofitted for some reason to give him this flaw to motivate action in the second movie. And it bugs me because it comes out of nowhere.
I would have to think about how that plays in the first movie, because I feel like there's something to that in the first movie, isn't there? It's not. They don't Mm-mm. play that up at all, anybody calling him chicken in the first movie?
Do they taunt him at all in the first movie? I don't think so. I mean, he gets challenged a couple of times by the same characters, by Biff and those guys, and there's the chase with the skateboard and the crash into the manure truck, but I don't think they're daring him there so much as he's just trying to get out of Dodge before they thrash him.
I'm not so sure about that. I feel like they at least touch on it, because everything in the second one stems from, like, everything that's in the future in the second one stems from, and not just a rage control problem, but because he crashes his car and messes up his hand and messes up his life and, you know, then falls into this pattern. So it is kind of a 30-year thing for him that, like, Needles is pushing him around and it winds up costing him his crappy job in, you know, middle management at whatever Japanese-owned corporation is sending faxes to his house and, you know, in every fax machine in his house saying, you're fired. So that's...
Yeah, but it doesn't come out of the first movie. It would be as if I made the next Star Wars movie and just you had everybody talking about how Luke Skywalker always had a problem with incontinence. You know, you always had a weak bladder, Luke, that always messed things up for you. Always ducking out on lightsaber fights to use the men's room. That's why you're a lame Jedi. And you'd be going, wait, I've seen how many movies at this point? This never came up before, his bladder problem. And it feels like a cheat to hang a movie or so much of a movie on a trait that's just not consistent with what you've established before.
I just Googled Marty McFly or Back to the Future chicken. And there is a clip here. It says chicken scene Back to the Future part one. Oh, wait. The whole chicken thing comes out of nowhere in part two. But I try adding it into the first film. All right, you have a point. It is not something... I'm not watching that movie for Marty's character motivation, I guess. I think that that's secondary to me. Then
it's just the hover skateboards.
Well, I'm a sucker for any kind of time travel parallel universe sort of thing anyway. Like, there's one network TV show that I'm watching right now, and it's timeless. And if I watch a second one, it'll be whatever the Jack the Ripper show is that ABC has. So I'm all in on that sort of concept and wherever, you know, parallel universes, alternate universes, and time travel can get you. So that does it for me. And I'm it's really chicken and egg because it's Back to the Future was a part of my childhood that way. But like Star Trek IV is my favorite of the Star Trek movies, and it's because you're getting the whole cast of the crew of the Enterprise back in like 1984 San Francisco, and you know, where are the nuclear vessels? I love the whole thing. So that's really my jam as much as anything. I given this this thought for the first time, I really have not thought about this.
You got to go back to it now. I think my favorite part of Star Trek IV, and it's very deflating for Captain Kirk, is that at the end of the picture, they're back in the future, to invoke that phrase again, and he says to, is it Catherine Hicks is the actress who plays the cetacean biologist? He says, essentially, can I take you out for drinks? Can we hook up? And she basically says, yeah, no, it's been a fun movie. Bye. It's such a change from the intergalactic rake that Captain Kirk was in the regular series. And in every movie, she just, and it doesn't help that William Shatner sort of waxed like the moon between Star Trek II and IV, so that they were supposedly stuck on Vulcan for a long time. He really liked the Vulcan cooking. He's just not that attractive, and there's a shot when he's diving under the Klingon ship to free the whales where his hairpiece almost lifts right off his head, and you can see clear down to his scalp, and you can understand why she would say no, and yet it's his movie.
Yeah. Yeah, Kathy Kirk through space, and but not through time. That's the thing. He does not meet the 1980s standard, but because, you know, in Star Trek VI, he's back to getting at it in the prison camp on the Klingon prison planet there.
I'm intrigued by this time travel thing because there's such a great literature of science fiction stories going back to at least, I mean, not just H.G. Wells, but Robert Heinlein did some of the great first, you know, time travel paradox stories. But I wanted to talk about a different form of literature because you brought this up. I had the same experience that you did writing for Team Magazine. I wrote for Yankees Magazine for a long time at the beginning of my career, and it was a lot of fun for a lot of different reasons. Like, people actually look forward to that. I don't know if it's on newsstands now, but it was on newsstands then, so it was kind of cool to see, especially as a young writer, to have. And we started talking about, you know, the corporeal newspaper. Well, back then, you know, it was cool to see you know your name in a corporeal magazine, the Slicks, as the old writers called it. But and I don't know if you've come across this, and this, I'm really curious how you'll handle this, if you haven't, and if you have, how you did handle it. But as you would expect from the Yankees, they were very sensitive about their image, even if it was something that happened 100 years ago. I did a lot of history type stuff for them in terms of, you know, this month it's the anniversary of Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak, or it's the anniversary of Rick Cerrone having the one ridiculous year of his career, or whatever. But if one of these guys ever did anything negative, if in the course of the story, if the story ever hinged on something negative, like I could be, you know, writing a story like, you know, the day that Joe DiMaggio bit an orphan, they would approve the story ahead of time on the pitch, but because I don't think they were really listening, to be honest. But when it came in, then we would get like, you know, George Steinbrenner reads this magazine, and he's gonna be very concerned about Joe DiMaggio biting an orphan. So we have to change it. We have to paraphrase. And sometimes they would work with me, and sometimes it would come back very, very softened. Maybe he kissed an orphan, or just gummed it, or he, you know, it was understandable because he was very hungry that day. So I'm just curious if you know, if you've been in that situation yet where the story that you wanted to tell kind of conflicted with the Rockies ethos or whatever they're trying to sell to people. If DJ LeMahieu did something rude or
bites an orphan
or troubling, would you have an issue there?
I've written, I think, two or three things for them now. I'm about to write my third or fourth. and it has not been an issue to this point. They did advise me when I joined up that, yeah, everybody in the organization reads this magazine, so you know, we like to portray the organization in a positive light. And I was like, yeah, I get that. This is, you know, this is the house organ of house organs. It's the magazine of the team that is sold in the stadium and given to season ticket holders and all that. So I feel like I had that idea anyway, that I wasn't really going to be touching on too much controversial stuff. I mean, the first thing that I wrote for them was about how my favorite Rockies players of all time were Roger Bailey and Jamie Carroll for different reasons. And obviously they would be.
I'm intrigued now.
Well, Roger Bailey is based off of basically fantasy baseball on the two good months that he had before blowing out his shoulder. And Jamie Carroll is my favorite player, just one of my favorite players anyway, going back to like when he was called up by the Expos at the end of the 02 season, and I was super into the Expos at that point, really late in the Expos existence, and that's a whole other story for other days that has been told elsewhere, and whatever, you Google me in the Expos and you'll find it. It was that, and then like I wrote about how the 07 Rockies didn't get off to a good start in April for the April magazine, so like April isn't everything, that sort of a deal. And then this answers it. I've written three things for them, about to write my fourth. The May thing was just about how young their starting rotation is this year, and just sort of where that echoes in history and stuff like that. So I have not touched on anything that would even really require editing out controversial stuff. So I know that it's out there. I know that it's an issue, but it's also something that I think that at the stage of my career that I'm at, going to write for a publication like that, I went in with eyes wide open to exactly what it was that I was doing, and that's fine. I'm not looking to ruffle feathers with the words that I write in the Stadium magazine. I'm really looking to write something that, you know, kids might enjoy if they're picking up this magazine at the ballpark and, you know, reading beyond just the scorecard. That's my goal in it, is to connect with the next generation me in another city. Somebody in that same boat, not necessarily somebody who wants to, you know, grow up and do exactly what it is that I do, because Lord knows I wouldn't recommend that. But just somebody, you know, a kid who likes baseball and likes reading and, you know, isn't looking for hot takes or columns or anything else, just, you know, some good old timey fashioned baseball reading. That's what I'm trying to give them. So I don't think I'm going to run into too much problem with that. Maybe I will. I don't know. Maybe my next story will be about, you know, Todd Helton snorting cocaine off the first baseline. I don't think it will. I have no evidence of that, and it's not really what I plan to do, but I do have a deadline in a week, and I need something.
Well, I don't think I was thinking about that, and I have to admit, you're making me wonder now. Like, I mean, I was in my mid-20s, so I honestly probably was just a little too full of pepper, and I'm asking myself, so why did you pitch those stories in the first place? Never mind why they took them. I mean, I know the answer, which is that I don't like doing, and I swear this is not to imply anything negative about what you're doing, because it, particularly the Jamie Carroll Roger Bailey angle sounds great, and immediately my ears perked up, and I was like, "Yeah, I would have commissioned that story too, because that's certainly off the beaten track." But you know, one of the first things that I read when I was a beginning baseball fan was Baseball Digest as it existed back in the early mid '80s, and most it feels like, and maybe I'm doing a disservice to this publication too, but it was very much aimed at the starter baseball fan, and every story was very positive and very general, with headlines like "Babe Ruth, he was quite a guy." And I always joke with writers when I've been an editor, or even as a columnist myself, when I've been stuck and I've said to an editor, you know, I've got a deadline coming up, what are you looking for? And I'm sure you've been in this position too. Sometimes the editor will say, because they're harried and they don't, you know, I don't know. So I say, well, I can always do Babe Ruth. What a guy. He was quite a guy, that Babe Ruth. And I never wanted to do that story when I became a professional writer. So what I became attracted to, and maybe this speaks to my personality as well, are the times that these great heroes showed feet of clay and that they failed and or that they weren't living up to their best selves, because I think that makes their best selves all the more interesting for the contrast. And so I pitch these stories that probably don't fit in, as you called it, the house organ of house organs. And I'm glad that they took them. And I'm kind of retrospectively now kind of sorry about any pushback that I might have given. I feel kind of retroactively embarrassed having spoken to you now. I don't think I was getting so much at Todd Helton. I won't even repeat it. But if they asked you, like, you know, we're celebrating the 15th anniversary of Nephi Perez's first game, or, you know, we're doing an Up with Dante Bichette feature, would you take that assignment? That's a harder one, right? Because as a freelancer, you know, the ethos is to please your editor, to get the assignment, do the job as requested. You're a tailor and you're customizing a piece for somebody. And then at the same time, you know, you've got your standards and you've got your honesty, and maybe you don't necessarily want to say that Nephi Perez was the Cal Ripken Jr. of the West.
Yeah, I think that there's wait, let's just go back a second here and let's be honest about Nephi Perez and how good he really was, because he was awesome. why he's not in Cooperstown now is a Shonda. I think there's a place for it, and I think that is the place for it. And, you know, the old Baseball Digest was the place for it in a way that you don't, and maybe because Baseball Digest then was more widespread, it felt a little more wrong in that way and less journalistic. But I think that there's a place for yay baseball that we don't, and because so much of it is on the internet now, and what goes on the internet is, you know, and it's something that we did at Sporting News a lot, was list of the worst X would do way better than list of the best X. Every single time. So
always, every time.
Negativity sells, and but there's a place for, like I said, for yay baseball. And if they asked me to do something on the 15th anniversary of Nathan Perez's debut, I'd be like, I have no idea why you're asking me to do that, but I am in. And like, if somebody has a problem with that and says that, like, I'm not doing service as a journalist because of that, well, no, I'm not, because that's not, it's not necessarily journalism, it's storytelling, and it's maybe, if you want to call it advertorial, I guess you could, but so long as, yeah, it entertaining, and like, if it's a story that can be well told and I'm the person to tell it, then sure, I don't particularly care that it's not hard hitting and, like, you know, blowing the cover off of years of fake humidor and whatnot, and, you know, they've really, the secret for the Rockies has always been that all of the bats are corked and they have a secret way of doing it. Let me tell the story of Nathy Perez and entertain a few people who will enjoy it and come away thinking, oh, yeah. Huh. Nephi Perez. I hadn't thought about him in 10 years.
I love this. I absolutely love this, Jesse. This is the perfect response, because, I mean, as you know, I began the introduction to this very episode. I talked about feeling jaded about some of this stuff. And you have every right to be jaded as well, I think. And what you're saying is you're not. And I think that's incredible. And I mean, I'm not shocked by it. again, it gives me a lot to think about for myself. I just really appreciate the perspective and the resiliency, and you're not treating it like, you know, the guy in the old, you know, Time to Make the Donuts commercial who's schlepping out of bed to his crappy job to make donuts. And I know everybody thinks that we have a wonderful, privileged, ridiculous way of making money, which is we get to write about a kid's game, to watch ball games, sometimes in person, sometimes hang out in the clubhouse and talk to these guys and you know, stand on the field during batting practice and that kind of thing. And it's true. It's a silly way to make a living, and it can be tremendous fun. So I don't want to downplay it. I think just sometimes that the obligations of doing these kinds of things that you brought up, like those negative stories that you were talking about, always do well. It's easy to lose track of the fact that, you know, every player is somebody's hero, and that there is a way to look at even a way below replacement level guy like Nephi Perez. I mean, and tell kind of a happier story about him.
And I'll go back to Roger Bailey on this. Like, that guy made the major leagues and was there for like 3 years, and maybe would have been there longer if he had stayed healthy. I don't know. He had started to fade a little bit. Maybe that was because of his shoulder being blown out and all that. He's 46 years old now. And at the time that he debuted, anyway, he's one of less than 20,000 people to ever do this job. There's something there. Like, all of these people, a lot of them are similar stories, and a lot of them don't carry at all. But, you know, how many people have played for the Colorado Rockies? Like 300 at this point? And they've been around for 20 years, so like 400, 500 guys? There's something there. There's, like, Roger Bailey was born in Chattahoochee, Florida. I know where that is, which is ridiculous. Went to Chattahoochee High School, Florida State University. There's stuff there on, like, it's a stupid thing, but everybody has a story to tell. And yeah, like, you know, thinking about the Yankees, there's like the one game that Rich Hill pitched for the Yankees, and then like he goes on to be the Rich Hill that we've seen the past couple of years, like this guy that everybody loves. And like, I would do, like, if Yankees Magazine would have me do it, I would do a story on Rich Hill's one game with the Yankees, or however, whatever it was. I don't know if they'd be interested in it, but I think it's interesting as heck. Like,
no, that would be a great story.
There's a few guys that have played like one game for the Yankees and been stars elsewhere, or, you know, whatever. And that applies to a bunch of different teams. And that kind of thing is interesting. Whether it's, you know, whatever perspective it's being told from, like, how did that happen, that a guy just played one game for a Major League Baseball team and then wound up somewhere else? Like, Rasheed Wallace's deal with the Atlanta Hawks, like, never played a, like, got traded to the Hawks, never played a home game. And then he got traded to wherever else he got traded to. Like, that's fascinating to me, because, like, he was at the, like, the peak of beating Rasheed Wallace, for one thing. And like, just fitting that into his whole career, that, like, he only played like one or two road games with the Hawks. And like, we all know about Mike Piazza and his, you know, week with the Marlins, but that's not a unique story. That's something that has played out with, you know, dozens of different guys and in lots of different ways. And each time you can be darn sure that it's interesting. One of the stories that I enjoyed reading most over the winter was, and I can't remember who did it. I want to say it was my buddy John Taylor at Sports Illustrated. It was about the guy who got claimed on waivers six times this offseason.
Oh, Richie Schaefer.
Yes. Yeah, do you see that story about the dude that got waived six times in the same offseason? And that part of it sort of sticks with you in a way. And, you know, maybe all of the details don't. I don't know. But it becomes part of the tapestry of just baseball in your experience.
It's really never the player. So when if I criticize Nephi Perez, or for that matter, a current guy like Alcides Escobar, it's not him. Like, I think we're probably alike in this way. I don't really root against any player except and maybe, you know, the guys who are, you know, wife beaters or, you know, have some other kind of off the field issue that makes them somebody who's uncomfortable to root for. But otherwise, I, you know, it's not his fault. It's not Nefi Perez's fault that managers kept asking him to hit leadoff or that he was on teams that overemphasized what he could do and de-emphasized guys that had better skills than him. I mean, all power to Nefi Perez for the career that he had. As you said, like Roger Bailey, you know, he did a lot more than many other players will get a chance to do. I think it's more, you know, you can say a lot of positive things about Nefi Perez and his accomplishments. What you can't really do, what's harder to do, and but this is fairer to Nefi Perez, is to say positive things about kind of Nefi Perez's career in context.
Yeah. I called up his baseball reference page. So he won a gold glove. Won a gold glove. Led the majors in triples in 99.
There you go. There's a whole article.
Led the majors in sacrifice bunts in 98, in triples in 99, won a gold glove in 2000, and played his entire career to 2.6 wins above replacement.
That's a little higher than I would have remembered given the career on base percentage below 300 despite playing at Wrigley Field and in Colorado.
Yeah. 297 career OBP, but the gold glove was, I would like to say, legitimate. Like, that was the reason he was in the major leagues, was that he could play shortstop.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is our Baseball Digest headline then. Nefi Perez, better than you remember.
Yeah. And Nefi Perez, career 149th in defensive war. Congratulations.
Right.
I mean, led the league in games played twice.
Somewhere in heaven, Tommy Thiebaud is looking down and proudly applauding Nefi Perez for carrying his banner of light-hitting, good field shortstops.
Yeah. So that's clearly the leading the league in triples is clearly a Coors endeavor.
Yes.
That's without question. I have to look now and see how many of those 11 triples in 99 were at Coors.
I'm intentionally not going to look, but I'm going to bet it's pretty much all of them, given that he had a 62 OPS plus.
Seven triples out of the 11 at Coors.
And how many of the home runs, of the 12 home runs?
Eight of the 12 home runs at Coors.
Well, you know, one thing I always say about home road splits with players, and this applies to Nefi Perez and this applies to Jim Rice. Mm-hmm. How many hitters went into Fenway Park and turned into Jim Rice? And the answer is very few. So you can say, well, you know, some people will look at that glass as half empty and say, Jim Rice was nothing but a park effect. And I'll say, no, he had a skill, and the skill was taking advantage of Fenway Park. So, you know, not everybody goes into Coors Field and piles up enough triples to lead the league in triples. You know, the one thing that Nefi did do, he never struck out, or at least by today's standards, he never struck out. So he put the ball in play. And in that outfield with the big gaps, you send it out there, chances are good things will happen.
Well, I did not expect to be talking this much about Nefi Perez. Now I'm looking. 57 steals, 45 caught in his career. That is abysmal. Dude, you're on base only 29.7% of the time. You can't be getting caught stealing like that. That's just brutal.
Are you old enough to remember in detail Alfredo Griffin playing?
Not in detail. I remember him mostly as baseball cards.
Alfredo, first of all, I was sort of one of the first of the Dominican shortstops, which Nefi obviously is a later addition to that lineage, but they were very similar players. The one difference is that, and I've written about this probably 1,000 times because it never stops fascinating me, is there was one year that Alfredo just decided he wasn't going to walk, and in like a 450 plate appearance season, he walked four times, which is incredibly special. But he was a one of the most unique base runners that you'd ever see. And this discussion of of Neffy's stolen bases. It reminds me of that because, and he went, Alfredo Griffin went a lot more than Neffy did, but it, the equivalent, and I was fortunate enough to see this in person several times, was kind of like that, a commando raid or a kamikaze attack, like almost as if he wouldn't really judge the pitcher. He wouldn't really consider the catcher. He wasn't concerned with anything really. He would just take his lead and then kind of, and just run down to second and get thrown out. And he never changed. The guy played forever and he would be really angry when an umpire thumbed him out. But it just this thing that he did over and over and over again.
That's fantastic. It's just the quarterback, the Rex Grossman school, just, I'm throwing it long. Don't care.
Doesn't matter if anybody's down there.
Yeah. I might get picked seven times during this game. It doesn't matter.
And it was fun. The weird thing is, it was fun. It wasn't good. Yeah. It wasn't winning, but it must have been hell if you were rooting for that team. But
if my team's bad, I want 25 guys like that. I don't want just run-of-the-mill kind of crappy players. I want guys who are, like, so, like, just... If I was a Reds fan right now, Billy Hamilton would be my favorite player.
Not Joey Votto.
Well, that's not true. Joey Votto is amazing.
No, I understand.
But you know what I mean.
Like, yeah, I do. I do. I mean, you want the 62 Mets.
Yeah.
You want Marv Thornberry dropping things and Richie Ashburn standing off in the side going, how the hell did I get here?
Yeah. If you're going to be bad, be real bad and have interesting guys who are bad. Like I root for Sunderland in the Premier League for the next few weeks until this season is over and they are finally put out of their misery and sent down a league. They're just not good. Like, they have Jermaine Defoe, who scores a bunch of goals and kind of does have that, what is he doing here? Like, he got called up to finally got called up to play for England during this season when he's, like, the only player worth anything on Sunderland. And the rest of the team, like, they're not fun. Like, the teams, they've had bad teams before. They used to have Kenwyn Jones, who would score the very, very occasional goal, but do cool flips when he scored. He had awesome goal celebrations. There's nobody like that on this team, and I'm bored of them. I'm not happy that they're going to be relegated, but I'm prepared for it, and I don't feel as bad for them as I would if they had any interesting people other than Defoe and Didier and Dong, who has hair that looks like French fries, that is amazing. not even just like regular French fries. Like, his hair is like curly fries. It's amazing. He's awesome.
It's very high cholesterol hair.
Yeah. He hasn't played very well to impress me or anything. The team stinks. And my daughter asked me, why are they so good at falling down? She's four and is quite keen to this. So, yeah, it's evident to anybody how much they stink. But if you're going to stink, put some stank on it, you know? And be interesting that way. Like, have Jeremy Bonderman go out there and lose 19 games and flirt with 20, and you know, Mike Muroth out there doing his kid and play dance. And yeah, the 03 Tigers have a special place in my heart for just how trash they were. But they were, like, they were so aggressively bad. And like, be yes. aggressively bad. And you can do that in baseball where you're not going to get relegated. So go out and do it. That to me is the worst thing about the Padres right now. Like, not only are they bad,
right.
they're just like, they're boring bad. Like, there's nothing worse than that, because if you're not going to win, at least be entertaining.
Yeah, absolutely. And I thought they might do that this year, with at least with the outfield that they had with Jankowski and Hunter Renfroe and Manuel Margot, and that they might at least, you know, run around and catch a lot of things and be entertaining that way. And it's early yet, so maybe that'll still happen. But I know that's kind of a thin thing to hang your season on, that and Will Myers.
Manuel Margot is fun, but he's not that kind of, like, I guess they do have Christian Betancourt, so that's something. That whole experiment.
He's almost a Bill Veeck kind of thing, just in that you know, they're making him a two-way player like Brooks Koscheck was or guys like that, but he can't really pitch at all.
Well, he can't really hit at all either, so.
Well, no, that's true. You start to lose track of exactly what it was that made him a prospect in the first place, because he never really excelled at hitting that I recall. And I'll end up looking
such a wide range of wonderful things that he is incapable of doing. So,
well, like you said, that's what we want. So, we've been.
I take it all back. Go go, 2017 Padres.
Be careful what you wish for. And I had to look this up. I just want to bring real fast closure on Alfredo Griffin, but yeah. Starting as a regular for the Blue Jays, his first year, he was a 21-year-old in 1979. He, his career stolen bases, 192 steals, 134 caught stealing, which includes years like 1979, 21 steals, 16 caught stealing, 1980, 18 steals, 23 caught stealing, 1981, short season, maybe they slowed him down a little bit too. 8 steals, 12 caught stealing. Back in positive territory in 1982, 10 steals, 8 caught stealing. 1983, 8 steals, 11 caught stealing. And then actually for the rest of his career, he got slightly better. He had an 11-3, a 24-9, a 33-16. But it really was a cool thing to see Alfredo run into an out or get picked off. He didn't do many things well, but he did that better than any player I've ever seen.
That's fantastic.
So I want to ask, just before we go, I want to touch on one current events thing, because, you know, I let us get sidetracked into all kinds of other things. But as we're talking here tonight, and the game is not quite over, so this will, you know,
will be over by the time this airs.
Yes. No, probably. that is definitely true. It's just it could always go to extra innings, and the number that I'm about to cite is it could go up, or, well, it can't go down, but it could go up by several. Eric Thames hit 2 more home runs tonight.
Really?
And he's up to 10. So as of the moment that we are speaking, he is hitting .373. With a .475 on base, because he also walked, and he's slugging a cool make Babe Ruth green with envy .910. And what strikes me as especially, I don't think ironic is the right word, but interesting about this is that last week or the week before, when he's gotten off to this incredibly torrid start after coming back from Korea, you started hearing people on the sports call-in shows and in other venues sort of going mumble, 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 Thames, PEDs, no way this is real. And then tonight or this afternoon, Steve Delabar, who is the guy that won the Blue Jays, and this was the esteemed Mr. Anthopoulos, dealt Thames to the Mariners. Steve Delabar was the guy they got back, and today he was suspended 80 games for having a contaminated drug test. He said that he used a uncertified supplement. I guess it was not on the list, and this is his explanation. Anyway, it's always an accident, and I'm you know what? I'm willing to take his word for it. And it was contaminated, but I find it especially piquant, tasty, that Thames was getting all this grief from people who can't necessarily accept what they're seeing, and the guy that he was traded for was nailed on this charge.
Yeah, former All-Star Steve Delabar, and that, if there's ever been a dilution of that, there it is, the All-Star nod that he got. That one sticks out to me more than so many others, because it was like at the very peak of like, we're going to put middle relievers in the All-Star game and see how this works. And really, the answer is not well, because nobody cares. And as much as I respect that, I am one of the people in this world who like grew up thinking it would be cool to be a middle reliever. And I find those guys to be among the most interesting in the sport, because they're seen as so fungible, and in a case of a guy like Steve Delabar, they often are. But there's also like these guys like, you know, a Mike Dunn, who, and you know, I'm sticking on a Rocky's theme here, I guess, but you know, he winds up there now to replace Boone Logan, who's sort of been another one of those guys who's like, this is a guy who's just sort of like in the middle of a bullpen year after year after year, and not just lefties, but like, but then you have a guy like Delabar who is in the majors, is good enough to be, you know, a middle reliever making an all-star team, even if that was sort of getting done to death at that point for whatever reason that they decided, like, oh, we don't want to just have the best relievers. We're also going to take a particularly good season, half-season middle relief guys, as if that really made sense and was a good way to sell the product. And I've gotten off on a tangent about this. It's a fascinating thing to me that that guy was an all-star. And also just lets you know that, like, yeah, any season, guy you've never heard of could wind up being an all-star. Like, it's not just that, like, maybe he's, like, the 1%, like, when you see the, you know, in baseball perspectives, when it's like, breakout, 1%, stays the same, 95%, completely falls flat, 4%. And you know, most of the time it's the 95% that plays out, but that 1% of the time, that was Steve Delabar, and maybe that's what it is with Eric Thames now, but maybe it's not. Maybe he went to Korea and really figured things out and is awesome now. I don't see why that's not possible. Like, happened with Prince Fielder. That was Japan, and it was, you know, not Korea, but Japan, but, and it was, you know, 20 years ago at this point, almost 30 years ago at this point, that he came back. Like, went to Japan, came back, and hit 50 home runs when nobody had hit 50 home runs since the 70s, like since George Foster. And that's another one. Like, you think of like the guys that hit 50 home runs, like that was a real exclusive club for a long time until the 90s happened and, you know, and everything went bonkers. But, like, for the longest time, George Foster was the last guy to hit 50 home runs. Like, a guy who, and maybe this is just, like, I don't have the right appreciation of George Foster as, like, a star slugger. But, like, what I remember him for was, like, he's the guy that the Mets cut in the middle of 86 because he stunk.
Yeah, he was about done by then. And he claimed it was racism.
Yeah.
Why he was cut. But, no, he was just kind of done.
Yeah. And I think that it was pretty much in evidence that by that point he was finished. So, I mean, I will admit to being that George Foster is one of those guys that, like, pretty much anybody who was, like, real good in the late 70s and sort of, like, on the way out in the early to mid 80s, I just have a weird view of. Like, Fred Lynn, I'm like, yeah, I know that he was supposedly really good, but, like, by the time I saw Fred Lynn, he was a husk of himself and, like, playing for the Padres and not a guy he'd be like, people were amazed by this guy? Like, people were, like, gaga for Fred Lynn, and he was Rookie of the Year and MVP at the same time. And
you raise a really good point in that I want to pick up on this because I feel like I wrote something just today about over at FanRag about the way, and this is kind of a hobby horse of mine, about the way that relievers are eating entire rosters. So in a way, it becomes natural that they end up on the all-star team. I'm not endorsing it. It's just that kind of like a virus, they're taking over. So and they're such a part of the way that the game is played today that it makes sense that they'd end up annexing that too. But you raise a really good point about the marketing of the game. And we just saw a story about a week or 10 days ago about how, and I feel like we see the story every year, but okay, we'll go with it. The kids don't have any awareness of any ball players. Like the top ranked ball players, as far as people's awareness of them, is still Derek Jeter. And he's been retired for a long time. They don't really know Mike Trout. They don't really know any of the great players. And there's always this hand wringing, about, you know, why baseball doesn't market their great players. And I've had some thoughts on that, particularly the fact that you only see commercials for baseball during baseball games. And it's like, hey, I'm already watching. You don't need to convert me. I'm already here. Like, put this on during, you know, the Big Bang Theory or something else that people who might not have thought about baseball for a while are watching. But I do wonder, when you do put, as good as we know that these pitchers can be, like, you know, if you put a Darren O'Day or a Steve Delabar on the All-Star team, what are you really accomplishing in terms of spreading the game?
You got me. I think O'Day is different because like anytime you can throw some side armors into the mix for the All-Star game, that's cool. Like, you know what? I don't care how he pitches. Pat Van Ditti should be in the All-Star game every year. Like, for as long as he wants to do it. For as long as, like, he's affiliated with a major league team in some way, shape, or form. Put that guy in the All-Star game and let it be a thing. Let him pitch the home run derby. Whatever you have to do to get the guy that pitches with both hands into the All-Star festivities, do it. Because that's awesome and people will talk about it. And isn't that... No, that's not really the point. Really, the point is honoring the, you know, the best in the game and whatnot. But isn't that really the point, to get people to tune in and talk about baseball? I don't know. I think that that's the balancing act that they deal with all the time, and I can't wait for all the insane discussions of that to start in another couple of weeks when the ballots come out. That's the silly part, is that, like, you know, voting starts, what, a month into the season? And we're supposed to believe that at least we don't have to pretend that, you know, that it counts anymore.
Right.
So if it's not going to count, let's have some fun with this stupid thing. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it should be what it always was, which was a pure exhibition. You just have to, with both what you're saying about having kind of the, you know, leaning on the entertainment portion of the game. I mean, heck, you could have a skills contest. I mean, back, you know, say in the 1930s, before ball games, you know, you might have, you know, like the big stolen base guy in the 1940s was George Case of the Senators, and you might have him race a horse before the game, you know, just to get a few extra people out there who might not have gone. They were on the bubble about going to that game, but they thought, I've always wanted to see a really fast guy race a horse. Mm-hmm. You know, that I think I'll go out there and see that. And, you know, if Joe DiMaggio gets a couple of hits for the visitors, then swell, you know. But I mean, if you lean on that, fine. But I wonder if, and this goes back to what I was saying about the commercials, if you've given up on converting the unconverted at that point.
Yeah, well, maybe you have. And what you really want to see, though, is make sure that you go out to the park and Joe DiMaggio doesn't bite any orphans, because that I've heard was a bit of a problem back in the day.
It, you know, he had appetite control problems,
but Babe Ruth was some kind of guy.
That Babe Ruth, he was a heck of a guy. And there's usually a quote from Wait Hoyt, because that was what Wait Hoyt spent his entire retirement doing, broadcasting Reds games and talking about what a great guy Babe Ruth was. And I just want to close on this note, which you brought up those breakout numbers in the Baseball Prospectus annual, and I never get tired of telling the story, but you know, I was in charge of seven of those. Mm-hmm. And when we did those numbers, there were always some bugs in the first run of them, and we had to go back and redo it and change them. And there was one year, and I'm gonna, you know, once we wrap up here, I guarantee you'll be going back to Baseball Reference one more time, that every pitcher, his most comparable pitcher in history, was a guy named Herm Wehmeyer. And even I had to, he said pridefully, even I had to go back and say, who the hell was Herm Wehmeyer? And I will leave it at that. Very little. I think if you look at that particular edition, there are still a few Herm Wehmeyers that made it into the final product, hopefully because they were the right comp.
Well, I'll say this. A Baseball Reference, I went to his page while you were speaking. Most similar pitchers by the similarity scores. There's a list of 10 here. Vic Sorel, I've not heard of, but some of the guys, Vic Sorel is number one there, but some of the guys on this list I have heard of and are guys that, you know, would pop up in a Baseball Prospectus, because Baseball Prospectus has all the players. Edwin Jackson, Doug Davis, Sidney Ponson, Omar Olivares, and Brian Moeller, who are generally who I would think of as... if you mention a Herm Wehmeyer to me, and you told me that Herm Wehmeyer pitched in the 1990s rather than the 1940s, as he did, 40s and 50s, primarily 50s, yeah, I would not. I would believe you, Herm Wehmeyer.
If we had had Herm Wehmeyer in the book that year, his most comparable pitcher would have been Herm Wehmeyer. And that's one thing I think we've learned today. We've learned that Babe Ruth is quite a guy. And I'll throw in that both Eddie Goodell and Nephi Perez should be in the All-Star game even now, even though one of them is dead and one of them is probably 75 years old.
Wait. Eddie Goodell is dead. Okay, jeez. I was like, Nephi Perez not dead? Jeez. Nephi Perez is, so far as I know, alive and well.
Eddie Goodell had gone to his reward back in about 1961.
Yeah. Yeah, he died. He died fairly... Well, because he was sick, wasn't he? Like, didn't he have health problems as a result of being so little? Or am I conflating that with somebody else?
It's entirely possible, but what I always think of, I think that William Goldman, the author of The Princess Bride, said that Andre the Giant said this to him on the set of the movie. And Andre was not well at that time. Yeah. Andre said, "We do not live very long, either the very large or the very small of us."
Yeah, I could be conflating it with that kind of thing, because I know that like a lot of the very large gentlemen, particularly of the NBA, have had short lives. You know, your Manu Bulls, your Andre the Giant among them. So sure, yeah, I don't know.
Well, that's an interesting note to conclude on, really.
I'll leave you this on a much happier note, and involving, since I just brought up Manute Bol, go ahead and let me make sure that it's there before I actually...
One of the few NBA players I've seen play in person, by the way. Basketball is not a game I've greatly interacted with.
Go ahead and just Google Ballad of Manute Bol, by a guy named Ken Queter, who local musician in Philly, who's been playing in Philly for years and years and years, continues to be active and like played at the bar on Tuesday nights when I was in college, and played there before, will continue to play there long after I'm dead, long after he's dead, he'll continue to have gigs at Smokey Joe's. So Ballad of Manute Bol is awesome. Go check it out and listen to it and enjoy and think happy thoughts of Manute Bol.
Excellent. And on the perfect note to end on a baseball podcast, sure, is a remembrance of Manute Bol. Yeah. Long may he wave. Jesse, I thank you for dropping by, and we'll do this again in a couple of weeks.
Can't wait.
That was the first Infinite Inning podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, and I suppose if you didn't, you can write us at InfiniteInning@gmail.com. Please be kind. We're figuring this out as we go. The Infinite Inning is brought to you, well, by nobody yet, but I suppose we can be like Sesame Street and say, by the number 37. Our theme music, The Infinite Man, was composed by myself and Rick Mooring. The producer is no one, as if you couldn't tell, and if you'd like to have that position, well, I'd be pleased to have you, as the less of that I do, I think the better it is for humanity. We'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.